This is People First Radio On Demand, podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads, available when you want to listen at chly.ca and at the People First Radio website.
CHLY 101.7 FM, Vancouver Island. On the web, www.chly.ca.
A recent survey of more than 2,500 Americans found that about one in four said they had experienced a great deal of stress in the previous month. And these stressed out people said that watching, reading, or listening to the news was one of the biggest contributors to their day-to-day stress. Mary McNaughton-Cassil is a professor at the University of Texas and a leading researcher on the connection between media consumption and stress. She says there is much more news available and so many different channels that are competing that they're trying harder to be sensational, and it's the traumatic events covered in a sensational way that create the most negative effects on media consumers.
I spoke with Mary McNaughton-Cassil earlier this week, and I began by asking her about the origins of the breathless, nonstop, calamity-style reporting, and I also asked her about her personal interest and how that developed.
That's a really good question, and I track my personal interest in this topic to the bombing of the Oklahoma City building. I had recently moved to Texas. To my husband and I were both at the university here, and we had small kids. And when I saw those images of the daycare that had been blown up, I started getting stressed, even though I knew my kids were in a daycare in Texas. And it dawned on me that because the news coverage now is so immediate and surrounds us, you can be pretty stressed about something that doesn't affect you directly, isn't even in your part of the world. So I started looking at those kinds of questions then, and of course, since then, we've almost fallen into patterns now, and there may have been some stories before Oklahoma City, but that's the first one I remember where all the news stations picked it up, covered it around the clock, kind of a constant repeat of the same facts. And now we sort of expect that. If Katrina or 911 or a school shooting happens, there's this saturation level. One of the things I started looking at was the literature in the communications field. And part of what they write about is that the pressures on the news media to compete with all the other entertainment that we have and to draw viewers and advertising have gotten progressively worse in the last 20 years with the internet and all the different cable channels, so that there's sort of a pressure on the news to keep the drama going and to really portray these things in ways that'll keep people coming back to see the news.
And now we have social media being involved as well, and the sort of tweeting and repeating and sharing. What impact does that have?
Instead of watching the primary news channels, it's sort of getting amplified that way. Now, there was an interesting study out in California during the wildfires, which showed that sometimes if you're immediately affected, social media can be very helpful. People were using it to figure out what roads were closed and what neighborhoods were burning. But again, that kind of brings me to a point I talk about a lot, which is that for most of us, what we see on the news is of something happening to people in a place we're unfamiliar with. If you're in the wildfire and you know the neighborhood, that information's helpful in your decision making. But if you're not there and you don't have anything to do, it just ramps up your anxiety. You worry about how the people there must feel. You think about how it could happen to you. And a lot of people tell me they feel helpless. They think, well, you know, these bad things are happening everywhere, and I can't really do anything to help any of those folks.
What are some of the other impacts on people? Does this type of experience actually cause things like anxiety disorders?
That's the most confusing question. There has been some research after 911 showing that people who watched a lot of coverage had increased anxiety, but most of the studies, mine included, tend to be cross-sectional, so you're just collecting data after an event occurs, and you can ask people retrospectively, were you anxious or depressed before, but you don't have a good measure of whether they were or how much they were. My sense is that it's probably a bit bidirectional, because sometimes people who are depressed or anxious select the news coverage they watch. You know, it doesn't really happen in a vacuum. But then I think if you are already upset and you see disturbing coverage, it can make you upset. For my research with college students and community folks, I don't find that high exposure actually correlates with things like clinical depression or clinical anxiety, but certainly elevated responses. So people a week after 911 reported feeling much more anxious, depressed, or angry than usual. And what I think is happening is that there's a little bit of a cumulative effect. Like you mentioned in the beginning of this summer, there's just been a whole series of disasters. Some people approach that, and I see this in my research, they become news addicts. They sort of need it on all the time because they're afraid they'll miss something. And then I have other people who turn it all off. They don't watch any of it. And that's one of the studies I want to do next. I'm wondering if maybe they're sort of the same people. It's two ways of coping with feeling overwhelmed by that volume of information.
Now, there are suggestions that these types of fears, and you might put them under the umbrella, the world is falling apart fears, can have specific effects on people's political views and how they make decisions about things as well. What have you heard or seen in that area?
Absolutely. I think that is a huge question. And again, it goes back to how our media has changed. You know, you have to be old enough to remember that we didn't used to have 24-hour news coverage. We had, here in the U.S., we had CBS, NBC, and ABC, and they did their evening shows, and that was it. Whereas especially young people, especially the college kids I work with today, have been surrounded by news their whole lives. They don't know any different, and they've just added the social media on to, you know, the 24-hour news. And because all of those news outlets are working so hard to draw attention, they tend to focus on negative things. So you can really have kind of a view that things have never, ever been worse. And what I argue, there's actually a book which is very hard to get a hold of, but it's called The Hater's Handbook, and it was put out in the 50s. And this author had gone back and looked at negative things said about politicians and public figures since the revolution. And when you read the kind of mean-spirited things people said about Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, you think, all right, the tone of political rhetoric maybe hasn't changed. But back then, you would only see those things if you had access to a newspaper and if you were able to read, and it might be delayed, whereas now, once they get a soundbite, they play it over and over and over. So I think we hear it more, it's disseminated more broadly. I'm not sure that really means that the commentary is worse. I had someone say to me recently, well, you know, Congress has never been in worse shape, and no one can get along. And I said, well, the Civil War was kind of worse. These things have changed. The other piece that I see among younger students is a tendency to have lost faith in the system, and the surveys show that. If you look at data from the 60s, people would have said, you know, I trust the government, I trust my doctor, I trust professors. And now all of those numbers have dropped, and a lot of undergraduate students say, well, you know, they're all corrupt. I don't trust any of them, and that's why I'm not going to vote, because it won't make any difference. And I had an honors student who was interested in that, so she did a survey of college and high school kids and asked them, you know, who are your heroes? And the gratifying thing for me was that these students all had a hero, but it was all a real person that they knew. So it was their grandmother or their coach or someone they had contact with. And I think that's because in the news media these days, no one goes uncriticized. And so they can't really believe in those folks. But they're still seeing that there are people who do things that are worth emulating.
So some people just turn off the bad news. Others take a break. You've also said that You know, we have a choice. We can really get conscious. And I'm quoting something you said in one of the articles I found. You say you can't change the externals. You have to get some control mentally. Tell us just a little bit more about that.
Well, that comes from my clinical training. In addition to teaching here at UTSA, I also have a private practice. And I'm trained in cognitive behavioral therapy, which is an area of psychology that says that your thoughts really drive the way you respond to the world. So the example I would give a college student is after I give a test, always, almost every time, there are two different people who come into my office. They both got a C on the test. One is ecstatic. They thought they failed. They didn't study. A C is passing. Another is near tears because they need an A. They want to go to med school. How could they have done so poorly? And the difference, of course, is in how they're thinking about the exact same external event. And so what I teach, I actually teach a stress management class, and I've written a book called Mind the Gap where I talk about this. I say that really stress is the gap between what you have and what you want. And that can be material things. It can be how you want your life to be. It can be how you see the world. And an awful lot of those gaps are things that we can't personally change. When people see starving children in Africa, they say, well, I can't fix that. And the truth is they can't fix it on the large scale. But where they can do something is in how they make decisions about what to do. So I push people to think, all right, if that's something that bothers you, what's a real small step you can do? Maybe you can go volunteer at your food bank or sponsor one kid through one of the national organizations or do something that helps you to feel like you are working on that gap without magnifying it into the extremes of it's so horrible, nothing can be done, or I'm so small that my efforts won't matter. And it takes a lot of conscious thought. As far as watching the news and having it on all the time, this one is hard to fight because sometimes you don't even want to listen. It's around in the background. But I've told students that I see the media and really technology as a whole in much the same way I see the increases in our ability to treat people medically or in our nuclear weapons race. We got the technology, but we didn't have time to figure out what it means in human terms and ethical terms. So, you know, after World War II, we question whether we should have used the bombs. After we keep a premature baby alive or we keep an elderly person alive, we start to wonder, well, is this fair to them? What's the quality of life? And I think the technology has crept into our personal lives that same way. And we all just kept going, all right, I'll get a cell phone. Yeah, now I'll answer my answering machine and my cell phone and Twitter and Facebook. And I find that a lot of people are reaching the limits. They're saying, I can't add any more technology. I need to start consciously eliminating some of those things. With college kids, the hardest part, though, is they use their phone for everything. And they tell me that they sleep with their phone next to them. In fact, I just came back from the American Psychological Association conference, and one of the presenters said that in his research, 60-some percent of people said they keep their phone near them at night, their cell phone. So it's hard to shut it all down.
I have a feeling that this will be a long challenge for society and for individuals.
And, you know, I don't want to advocate rolling back. I don't think it was better when news was really hard to get and, you know, battles went on because the news hadn't reached the front that a ceasefire or an end of the war had been called. And I have this conversation with my students all the time. Had we known about John F. Kennedy's personal life or even FDR or other prominent figures, you know, it might have changed how we saw their presidency, and people were able to kind of avoid those negatives because the news media didn't cover them, and I don't see that as necessarily good. But on the other hand now, we are flooded with so much negative information, and a lot of it fairly biased in both directions, that it's really hard for people to even figure out what they believe anymore, or who's right, or what's accurate.
Thank you very much for taking the time to join us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Mary McNaughton Castle is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Texas in San Antonio. She's a leading researcher on the connection between media consumption and stress, and is the author of Mind the Gap, Coping with Stress in the Modern World.
This is a People First Radio podcast. People First Radio is an initiative of Columbian Center Society in partnership with the Radio Malaspina Society and produced at CHLY Community Radio in Nanaimo, British Columbia. The opinions expressed in this interview do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the partnering organizations. Visit us online. Just Google People First Radio to find our webpage.